From Tribune Tower, WGN Radio presents a conversation.
I want to make one thing perfectly clear.
A dialogue.
What are you prepared to do?
An astute debate.
Everything within the law.
And a peek behind the curtain of politics.
And then what are you prepared to do?
I think Chicago is not only the center of the country, I think it's the center of the world.
Don't tread on them.
Where did this statement come from?
This is the Sunday Spin. Your host is the Chicago Tribune's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning, everyone. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, and welcome to this week's edition of the Sunday Spin for November 15th, 2015. Thank you very much for joining me this morning as we launch our weekly look at the politics of last week and what to expect in the days ahead. So, yes, it's time. Grab that hot cup of coffee, get the Sunday paper, and let me be your electronic news wallpaper as we try to get your week off to a good start. Well, I know, Dave, I always try to get things started off on a little bit of a lighthearted look, but...
And you usually do, yes.
But, you know, there's been some serious events in the past week that make it hard to see things through that kind of lens.
Absolutely. That's true.
Of course, we have the multi-pronged terrorist attacks in Paris on Friday night, and this growing realization that there may be few options to deal with ISIS, with Syria, with terrorist threats growing, that... Perhaps military force, boots on the ground, may be the only option. But I want to start out this morning with something that really disturbed me, something that happened last week at the University of Missouri. Now, student protests are a fact of college life. It's part of the learning process. It's part of finding out who we are as individuals. And it's been a unique time at Mizzou, the resignation of the school's president and chancellor, a result in large part by the threat of a boycott by the school's African-American football players, backed up by their coach. Concerns about racist attitudes by many on one of America's great college campuses. But what really bothered me was the treatment given to two student journalists trying to cover a protest on the school's quad, a public space. Now, I have strong feelings about this, not only as a journalist, but also as a parent of a Mizzou student. So you had one student journalist working for ESPN who was forcibly moved away from the protest area by a member of the school's staff, a director of Greek studies. Remember, this was on public property. And then a second student journalist, Mark Schierbecker, was verbally harassed and threatened with physical intimidation by a faculty member, Melissa Click, who teaches communications.
Hi, media. Can I talk to you?
No, you need to get out. Well, you need to get out.
No, I don't.
You need to get out.
I actually don't.
All right. Hey, who wants to help me get this reporter out of here? I need some muscle over here. Help me get him out. Who's going to help me?
Are you documenting? What are you
I'm
doing?
I'm documenting.
Okay, well,
you need to get out. You need to get out.
This is public property.
Yeah, I know. That's a really good one. I'm a communication faculty, and I really get that argument. But you need to go. You need to go. You need to go.
Now, I'm sorry, but this is flat-out ridiculous. Campus police are investigating this. Mark Schierbecker, the student, has filed a complaint with police. But my simple bottom line is this. Instead of Mark Schierbecker being told to go, Melissa Click should be told to go. Go away. Far away from the Missouri campus. Now, yes, she apologized, but I have to tell you, there is no apology strong enough to excuse the fact that she threatened a student on campus in a public space with physical intimidation. Can we get some muscle over here? Really? Words spoken by a faculty member to a student. Can we get some muscle over here? We don't need some muscle. We need some brains. And my hope is at Missouri, the officials show some brains and show Melissa Click the way out of Columbia, Missouri. In my view, there's never any excuse for a teacher to threaten a student. And that's my two cents, and that's my response to paying tuition there.
I have a question as
sure.
well here, if I may just chime in for a minute. Here is a person who's teaching communications, and when I saw this story, I immediately wondered, this person teaching communications, media, and knowing how news is gathered, why they would want to move a reporter away who was they were doing their job. And as you said, Rick, at a, on a public space, you know, what was going through their mind when they wanted to forcibly remove someone who was doing their job and being paid for it?
Well, and I want to point out that, yes, Melissa Click teaches communications. She is not a journalism teacher. She's not in the School of Journalism, the noted School of Journalism there. She teaches basically kind of pop culture mass communications, okay, which is not an excuse. I don't care. That's not an excuse. It's a public space. You're being paid for by tuition and tax dollars. And one of the ironies of this is so the student journalist, Mark Schierbecker, he works for a student publication at the University of Missouri called the Maneater. And the Maneater because they're the Missouri Tigers, okay? But I found out that Melissa Click is has some kind of faculty advising role for the Maneater, the very same publication. So she's basically telling, you know, here again, she's telling a student, and what is the student to make of this? One, not only the physical intimidation, but if he objected too strongly, would that somehow be reflected in, you know, being blacklisted on grades and that kind of thing at the school? I mean, the lack of professionalism here is I just find it completely galling. I don't know about you, Dave, but it's a very sad moment. And as I said, as a parent, you know, I think I have a right to speak out here.
Sure, you would be equally concerned about, you know, your child's safety there and their involvement in all that was going on. Most definitely a very big national story earlier this week.
Yes, and on an upcoming show, I will be talking to my daughter, Kate, who is a student in the School of Journalism. Fortunately, I did call her just to see if Melissa Click was one of her teachers, and she assured me she was not. But that's my two cents, and she did resign a courtesy appointment in the journalism school, but she still remains on the communications faculty at Mizzou. And I'm very, very troubled by that. Well, Dave's here to keep us all up to date on the news and the traffic. Producer Jasmine's fielding your phone calls, and you can reach us at 312-981-7200. You can also text us at 312-981-7200. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/thesundayspin. We're on Twitter at @SundaySpin. Engineer Bob is pushing all my buttons today, although Melissa Click seemed to have done a pretty good job of that already. And just remember, if you miss any of this show or want to listen to our past shows, you can keep up with our podcasts at WGNRadio.com, and you can also go to iTunes and search for Rick Pearson. Coming up, we've got a great show. After Dave brings us the 7:30 news, we'll talk to 12th Ward Chicago Alderman George Cardenas. After the 8 o'clock newscast, we'll be speaking with two whistleblowers at Hines Veterans Hospital about the conditions they found there. And then after the 8:30 news, former Illinois House Republican leader Tom Cross joins the show, and we'll be discussing developments in Springfield, as well as an event Thursday at Aurora University, which I'll be moderating with the authors of the book, Fixing Illinois. We're going to take a quick break. You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN. It's 7:20 on this Sunday morning. Welcome back to The Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson. It's time for our weekly spin through national politics. And, of course, there's international politics, too. And, of course, we'll start with President Obama speaking to the nation after the deadly terrorist attacks in Paris on Friday night.
Those who think that they can terrorize the people of France or the values that they stand for are wrong. The American people draw strength from the French people's commitment to life, liberty, pursuit of happiness. We are reminded in this time of tragedy that the bonds of liberté, égalité, and fraternité are not only values that the French people care so deeply about, but they are values that we share. And those values are going to endure far beyond any act of terrorism or the hateful vision of those who perpetrated the crimes this evening.
Now, with the president's foreign policy strategy towards ISIS under renewed fire, it was expected that the ISIS attack in Paris would be part of last night's Democratic presidential debate. Now, Hillary Clinton came under fire from Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders for being too close to Wall Street, part of his economic message. But Clinton said her ties to Wall Street were in part due to terrorism.
I represented New York on 9/11. When we were attacked, where were we attacked? We were attacked in downtown Manhattan, where Wall Street is. I did spend a whole lot of time and effort helping them rebuild. That was good for New York, it was good for the economy, and it was a way to rebuke the terrorists who had attacked our country. So, you know, it's fine for you to say what you're going to say, but I look very carefully at your proposal. Reinstating Glass-Steagall is a part of what very well could help, but it is nowhere near enough.
In fact, climate change is directly related to the growth of terrorism. And if we do not get our act together and listen to what the scientists say, you're going to see countries all over the world. This is what the CIA says. They're going to be struggling over limited amounts of water, limited amounts of land to grow their crops. And you're going to see all kinds of international conflict.
Some very interesting answers dealing with terrorism from last night's debate, Hillary Clinton and then Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders. Republicans, of course, they had their own debate last week, but Donald Trump appears to be feeling some pressure as his poll numbers start to weaken against Dr. Ben Carson. At a late week event in Iowa, Trump noted that Carson had said he had, quote, pathological, unquote, tendencies as a youth. Then Trump kind of went off the rails. He made these same comments to CNN.
You know, when he says he went after his mother and wanted to hit her in the head with a hammer, that bothers me. I mean, that's pretty bad. When he says he's pathological, and he says that in the book, I don't say that. And again, I'm not saying anything. I'm not saying anything other than pathological is a very serious disease. And he said he's pathological. Somebody said he has pathological disease. Other people said he said in the book, and I haven't seen it. I know it's in the book, that he's got a pathological temper or temperament. That's a big problem because you don't cure that. That's like, you know, I could say, they'd say you don't cure, as an example, child molester. You don't cure these people. You don't cure a child molester.
That's the latest from Donald Trump. Republicans, of course, began the week with that debate. Ohio Governor John Kasich, looking for a bump in the polls, immediately went after Donald Trump's deportation plan.
For the 11 million people, come on, folks. We all know you can't pick them up and ship them across back across the border. It's a silly argument. It's not an adult argument. It makes no sense.
All I can say is you're lucky in Ohio that you struck oil. That's for one thing.
Carson, who's fighting back over the scrutiny that he's getting, he pushed back against Hillary Clinton rather than directly address that controversy over a West Point scholarship offer that never existed.
Now, when I look at somebody like Hillary Clinton, who sits there and tells her daughter and a government official that, no, this was a terrorist attack, and then tells everybody else that it was a video, where I came from, they call that a lie. And I think that's very different from, you know, somebody misinterpreting when I said that I was offered a scholarship to West Point.
Now, Trump, of course, has faced criticism over how he deals with women. And at that debate, he took on Carly Fiorina.
And Ronald Reagan walked away at Reykjavik. He walked away. He quit talking when it was time to quit talking.
Can I finish with my time? Why does she keep interrupting everybody?
Yeah.
Florida Senator Marco Rubio, seeing a rise in the polls, he criticized the lack of attention being given to vocational education.
For the life of me, I don't know why we have stigmatized vocational education. Welders make more money than philosophers. We need more welders and less philosophers.
So that was a good applause line, but actually somebody did some research and found that studies show philosophers, if you can get a philosophy job, that philosophers do make more money than welders. And so finally, yes, I'm sorry, but Donald Trump again. During the debate, he criticized the Obama administration over the Trans-Pacific trade deal, as well as attacking China.
China in particular, because they're so good. It's the number one abuser of this country. And if you look at the way they take advantage, it's through currency manipulation. It's not even discussed in the almost 6,000-page agreement.
Hey, Gerard, you know, we might want to point out China's not part of this deal.
Yeah. True. It's true.
That's right. China is not part of the Trans-Pacific Trade Agreement. Trump later went on to say that, oh, he knew that, but he was talking about how China would adjust its currency in the back door while all the attention was being focused on trying to reach agreements for with other countries over the Trans-Pacific Trade Deal. Well, that's our spin through national and international politics. We'll be back with more on the Sunday Spin. Coming up ahead on the Sunday Spin, we'll be speaking with 12th Ward Alderman George Cardenas. We'll be talking about the Chicago Latino Caucus Foundation Gala that's coming up with a goal of giving out a huge number of scholarships. So that's we'll be talking about that. We'll also be talking, of course, city politics, and there's never a shortage of things to talk about when it comes to talking about what's going on in the city.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson. You heard Dave talking about St. Louis and the Bears in St. Louis today at noon. I'm kind of feeling maybe pretty good about this one. St. Louis is a tough team, but so many people I know, last night the Blackhawks beat the St. Louis Blues in St. Louis 4-2. And I know so many people who went down to St. Louis for the weekend to have kind of this hockey-football doubleheader, which, you know, that maybe I should have taken the show on the road. Who knows? But let's go Bears. I want to mention, and we're going to talk about this as well later in the show, I want to mention this event at Aurora University, part of their Town Square series. I'll be moderating a panel with the authors of the book Fixing Illinois, Jim Nolan and J. Thomas Johnson. And those guys have been around, and they've come up with a number of ways that they see to kind of get Illinois moving again. I'm very anxious to talk to them in light of the fact that, you know, here we are still without a budget in the state of Illinois, still with some serious financial issues. So that's coming up on Thursday at 7:30 p.m. at the Creamy Auditorium in the Institute for Collaboration at Aurora University. And you can find more about this. You can go to AU Arts and Ideas, AU Arts and Ideas, one word, .com, or you can call 630-844-4924. And as I said, we'll be talking to former House Republican leader Tom Cross about this event. Tom was one of the architects of putting this together, so I think it'll be well worth your time. Now, that's on the 19th, but on the 20th, the Chicago Latino Caucus Foundation is having its gala at the Field Museum at 6 o'clock. And joining me now on the phone is Chicago Alderman, 12th Ward Alderman, George Cardenas. Alderman, thank you for getting up with me this morning.
Thank you, Rick. Thanks for waking me up.
It's always good to be the alarm clock for other people, you know. But this gala, now granted, it is $1,000 a ticket, but it has a very laudable goal.
Well, you got to set high expectations. It is a laudable goal. I mean, we're talking about students. We're talking about children in the next generation of leaders, if you will. So we got to set the benchmark high for them. And for folks, that they got to take it seriously to, you know, to also give back and put a structure in place that these kids can then take advantage of, not just giving a scholarship, because I think some of that we're going to do that. But doing the mentoring and linking them up with the businesses that are going to, you know, be hiring them later on in the future, talking about advocacy and the things, issues that are germane to them. You know, it's something that we should have done years and years ago. But I think the Latino Caucus has the position, has the leverage, if you will, to sort of bring about something like this and make it really wonderful. You know, we're obviously in the business. We, according to the Sun Times and everybody else, we own the violence. We own everything else. Why not own something that is going to produce success stories, you know, again and again. I think that to me, that's a wonderful thing.
Well, and you know, we always hear, and I'm not speaking critically of you, but we hear from every politician that education is our number one priority. And to put on this event with the goal of generating $500,000 for scholarships, you know, it's nice to see for a change politicians putting, you know, words into action.
Exactly. I mean, you do have to sacrifice, you know. I mean, someone will say, well, how is it going to hurt your fundraising and your end? And sometimes you got to put that aside. And may, you know, it may not. Who knows? Who cares? But let's do this because I think it's important. So I've set a lot of things aside for now and made it my goal. And I know the rest of the council has made it their goal. And everybody's pitching in. And they're doing a wonderful job of saying, oh, you know what, I know this guy, I know this person, they're coming in, I invited them, they think it's a wonderful thing, and they're going to be there. And you know, the Field Museum is something special. This has to be special. We all have to own this as a community to do this, because I think it benefits all. One of the statistics that I was talking about to people is, look, Hispanics are now 46, pretty coming up fast at the 50% of the school district in the city. So these kids, the majority are going to be Hispanic, but the numbers are not telling when they graduate from high school and they graduate from college. The numbers are not there justifying that huge increase, and that does not bode well for, you know, for obviously not just the Latino or community, but also businesses. You know, you're seeing the city moving a lot of companies to bringing a lot of companies to the city. And setting up the corporate headquarters and everything else. Well, where is the future for that? We need to line up those priorities and have these kids be able to attend college, understand the importance of joining, you know, society in this endeavor. And believe me when I tell you, benefits everybody, because if we're seeing those numbers, and that means that they a lot more have to get to college graduation so they can join the workforce and so they get everybody benefit.
The one thing about and the college education, and yes, it's so important these days, particularly when you look at kind of the way that the job skill needs have changed into digital and technology, and, you know, can you write code? That's kind of the key word. But I'm also concerned about the affordability issue.
Well, I mean, certainly that's what we're fighting. It's to be able to give some of these folks and some of these kids, you know, something, access to something that's not really affordable but doable, and they can succeed. Not everybody's going to go to college, but we also got to create that environment for them to make that decision. A lot of them could become entrepreneurs, could become, you know, good at computer science or coding, and they may decide to do something different. You know, I see a lot of people that started businesses that way. So let's create the foundation. Let's create the base. And this is why the foundation, it's really for that. It's a foundation for them to build and to link up with the outer world. And we want to be able to do that. We want to be that body that makes sure that, you know, it happens.
So for people who want more information about the gala, how do they learn more about this?
Well, they can certainly Google, and there's a Facebook page for the Gala Chicago Latino Caucus. They can do it that way. I think we set up a page also. If you Google it, you'll be able to find it, a link to it. You could do that. And you can also call the office this whole week, call the office, call my office, any of the aldermanic offices. That people can easily Google too, and you know, I can certainly give my information out as well here. But the information is easily Googleable. It's on Facebook, and it's also on the web for be able to get the links and then be able to buy the individual tickets.
So look for Chicago Latino Caucus Foundation Gala. Alderman, stay right there. We're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to talk a little bit about what's going on in the city, and we'll talk about education and the Chicago Public Schools, as well as what's happening with the UNO schools. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin.
Sunday
7:48 on this Sunday morning. I'm Rick Pearson, and this is the Sunday Spin. And joining me on the phone is 12th Ward Alderman George Cardenas. Alderman, I wanted to talk to you about this issue of the United Neighborhood Organization and the issue of six UNO-owned schools serving 4,000 students, perhaps facing bankruptcy. What's going on?
Well, you know what? It's unfortunate that they find themselves in this situation. If folks were tuning in for some of the news about a year and a half ago, UNO was ordered to separate their entities because of some of the stuff that had gone on and some of the management issues that were not done properly, some bidding and so on. So now they find themselves in this situation where one of the entities, which UCSN is called, which is the United Charter School Network, has really decided to in the plain hardball, in essence, and bring about probably the demise of the UNO organization. There's no other way to say it, really. It's unfortunate that has come to that, not by paying them the management fees and the arrangement that has been set forth by the judge that said about the separation. And I know some of us in the council have been really involved in getting them to the table so they can both do what they got to do and move on if that is the case. So, you know, pay the bills, pay the organization so they can really survive. And then, you know, if they change their mission, then they can do that. But certainly you got to be able to do that. I think it's just the right thing to do.
Well, and I know that there's these issues of a $2.2 million management fee balance that's owed, unpaid rent of more than $2.1 million. And then, of course, there's the loan issue to UNO of the $31 million used for completion of one of the campuses. Is it just a matter that neither side is I know that UNO maintains that UCSN is not talking, is not dealing. Are they talking?
Well, they've sat down obviously several times. They just haven't pulled the trigger. I think they made a payment when Jesse Ruiz was the interim CEO of the schools, he set them down and obviously it's a payment made. And, you know, this has become a lot of legalese because there's no other way to put it. The contract was not really clear on some of the issues, and I think they've taken advantage of it. But I think the leadership at UCSN maybe thought about this at the situation where the bankruptcy it could happen at any moment. They benefit from it. But I think the right thing to do from just, you know, Hispanics, we talk about, you know, uniting and doing the right thing. And they got to do the right thing and make sure that this UNO organization gets paid and continues some sort of the mission that they started, you know, years and years ago. This organization has been around 30-something years, started with all the right reasons and can continue on its mission of providing some leadership. It's still a segment of what's called MLI, which is the leadership for professionals. I think it was done very well, and it's got some potential, but it's gonna have to, you know, it's gonna have to get some revenue, some quick infusion of funds right away from UCSN for them to move on and be successful. And I think the onus is on UCSN to make sure that this happens.
Do you think that bankruptcy is a real possibility here, or is it just part of the legal threat?
No, it's really, I think they're probably at the brink of that right now, simply because obviously, as you know, without funds, you just can't operate, right? And their revenue was a management revenue that came from managing the charter school network and some other entities, but that also was taken away when UCSN separated. They had a JAMS contract of cleaning the schools, and that also was voided practically. So, you know, everything has been done to sort of clear for its demise. And it's unfortunate. I think your leadership, as you said, you know, they got to do this. I think otherwise they're going to create a big rift in the Latino community.
I want to switch over to Chicago Public Schools and also some of the city's budget needs. In recent weeks, we've heard Governor Rauner talk about what he believes will be some of the action that will ultimately lead to a state budget, and his belief that the needs of the city of Chicago will play a critical factor in leveraging Democrats that control the General Assembly into supporting what the governor calls his structural reforms. Critics would say that they're union weakening, pro-business reforms. But you have the money needs of the public schools. You have the issue of trying to change the ramp on police and fire pensions. Where do you see this leading to? Because certainly, you know, the mayor has said, you know, if you're looking at me to try to leverage union weakening reforms, you're looking at the wrong guy.
Yeah, I think, you know, that should not be the idea or the goal. I think goal should be to be clear about what has to happen. I mean, you can't tax yourself out of this pension mess. You just can't. I mean, we just did, you know, raise the property taxes in a historic high. And you can't do more. You can't put it all on the taxpayers, the pensions. And there's been problems been being sort of, you know, exacerbating every year after year. And what the courts have said that, you know, changing the benefits or trying to take away some of the benefits that have been already given, you can't take them away, but you can take you can change the plan. And certainly and there's nothing in the Constitution that says you must do a defined benefit pension plan. So we can change the plan to make it a hybrid perhaps and change some of the stuff that it's causing this pension to accumulate. It's certainly the participation of pensioners and folks that are in the pension system, you know, must be part of the solution because, you know, take it as an example, yourself and everybody else that we talk to on the street, nobody has that type of setup where they pay very little into a very generous pension. It's just not sustainable. You know, we looked at the numbers and, you know, you would have to increase taxes, you know, every year by an ungodly amount to be able to sustain that level of the level of benefits payouts to pensioners, people who are in the pension system. I think somebody that retires when they're 55 in the city and draws a pension for till they're 85, I think we end up paying to 1.8, I think according to the numbers, 1.8, almost $2 million out for that particular person. There's 70-some thousand retirees right now, and there's 80,000 something employees in the sort of the countywide in the pension systems. So if you look at those numbers and you see how the one column here, it's the one that's increasing, and the column that's increasing is a column of retirees and folks that are not paying into the system, let alone, you know, anything else. So the takeout can't be one-sided. And has to change from you know, not just on our end, but also in Springfield. It's really to make sure that the reforms, the structural reforms that they talk about, really look at the plans going forward. Even if you start now, you know, if you start now and say, look, if we start now, we can work ourselves out of it, but you got to start somewhere. And follow the courts, as they say. You can't change the benefit. You can't change the contract in the middle of its duration. But you can certainly change the beginning, right? The start time. And I think some of that, whatever is legal, I think has to be put into the mix for this to succeed for everybody. I mean, I don't think you want the schools to go bankrupt, and I don't think folks, you know, should lose their pension. They have to be smart about it. So, you know, being anti-union, I think it's not. I think that's not the solution. It's you know, I think the solution is is putting it on the table and saying, look, this is a reality. This is what's coming in. This is what's being paid out. You know, something we got to do something. We can't put it all on the taxpayers. And I think it makes sense.
I want to thank you, Alderman, for joining me. 12th Ward Alderman George Cardenas. He is chairman of the Chicago Latino Caucus Foundation Board. And as we've been talking about, their big gala coming up on November 20th at 6 o'clock at the Field Museum. Thank you very much, Alderman.
Thank you, sir. Thanks, Rick. And I hope people see you there on Friday. Bye.
We'll be back with more right after this.
This is the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN. Once again, here's Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune.
312-981-7200 is our phone number. I'm Rick Pearson. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I've got a message on our Facebook page from Dave saying, with what happened in France, how can Obama and the U.S. think about letting in even one Syrian? And, of course, this is going to become a much more topical issue in light of what happened in France. And you already have some countries saying that they are rescinding their agreement to take in Syrian refugees. And you can expect more and more of this to be part of the debate in the coming weeks and in the aftermath of what happened in Paris on Friday night. Well, joining me now here in the Showcase studio, Dr. Lisa Nee, cardiologist, and Jermaine Clarno, a social worker. I was at a hearing last week that Senator Mark Kirk held, a subcommittee hearing, in which each of them testified as whistleblowers over the problems that they found over at Heinz. And it's kind of, we were talking off air, I said earlier about how politicians like to talk about education's my number one priority, and you have politicians also talk about we've got to help the veterans, and of course we just had Veterans Day, but these problems that you mentioned, you both mentioned in that subcommittee hearing, they're just so egregious and galling, you can't imagine. It just runs counter to what I think everybody thinks. And Dr. Nee, you mentioned, you know, you first started surfacing these issues
almost
5 years ago.
Correct. 4 years, 8 months.
Well, Doctor, I'd like you to kind of maybe if you could summarize some of the things that you found during your time over at Heinz.
Well, I think, you know, the most important issue is harm to patients, and it was pretty deep-seated in the healthcare delivery there across the board. It was at times negligent, it was times directly harmful, and at times caused death. And for someone who had been involved in healthcare, you know, my entire career, I had never seen anything like that, where you could bring forth these issues and no one wanted to take them on because they already knew about them. It just runs counter to everything you stand for as someone who delivers healthcare to patients.
Well, you mentioned that the first thing you discovered were these tests for cardiac ultrasound.
Correct.
Tests that were just being shoveled into bank boxes.
Yep, the tests were done and they're charged for, and then they were put in bankers' boxes and hidden somewhere. I'm still to this day not sure where they were kept. They were brought out one by one, and I was instructed to read them. The finding of the boxes was appalling enough, but then to realize that some of these patients had already died as I was pulling up their record was something that I just could not stand by and allow to happen.
So the tests were done. The paperwork just tossed in a box till whenever somebody got around to it?
I think that was how it was handled.
And as you said, and then, I mean, these were people that needed cardiac care.
Right. In order for you to have one of these tests ordered, someone has a suspicion that there may be a problem with your heart to begin with. This is not a screening test. I mean, this was ordered by a primary care physician.
So as a specialist to the specialist kind
right.
of thing to for specialized treatment.
Right. And I think what's more important for the public to understand is in the private sector, these tests are read within a very short period of time. If you're an inpatient in the hospital, they're usually read the same day. If it's an outpatient, they're read within 48 hours. And you're talking about tests that were sitting in boxes for a year.
And, I mean, this is, we're talking about your heart. This is people, I mean, this is the fundamental, organ in the body.
Well, and many of these patients were waiting for maybe possible clearance, to undergo another surgery. So not only are you delaying a diagnosis of their heart, you're delaying something that they may very well needed much more urgently, certainly within a year's time.
So when you started reporting these issues, what happened?
Well, honestly, when I started reporting the first issue, I really thought it was someone's oversight. Clearly, someone must not have known this was going on, and we were going to rectify it. We were going to take the box, and we were going to stay all night, read the tests, get them done, and notify the patients. And it was horrifying to find out that not only did people know about it, all the way up the chain of command, people knew about it and had allowed this to happen. As a physician, now you know you're in big trouble, because if this has been a collusion among all the people working there, you're not going to be the person that they're going to suddenly welcome with open arms to solve this problem.
And so you faced retaliation.
Harsh retaliation for really just wanting to help patients. And that's my job as a doctor. I'm the patient advocate. I should not be put in that position.
And that retaliation took what kind of forms?
It took many forms. It took forms of not being paid the same amount of other people in the department, regardless of the fact that I had similar or even more training. It was not ever getting a bonus. It was being put in an office where there was flooding. It was then being put in an office where there was asbestos. It was being denied my Family Medical Leave Act when I was pregnant. I mean, the list goes on and on. Those are some of the things I have proof of, as you know. Some of the retaliation that can occur in a workplace, you're not going to have a video of someone retaliating against you. So being alienated within the department and being told that now I have to suffer for trying to stand up for the patient, to me, is retaliation enough above and beyond everything else that went on. Now I have to live with the fact that how am I going to work my way out of this situation and still help patients?
We're going to talk more about this issue with Dr. Lisa Nee and Jermaine Clarno, social worker, and two whistleblowers over at Hines, and some of these very, very serious issues. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson, and I'm joined here in the Allstate Showcase studio by Dr. Lisa Nee and by Jermaine Clarno. And they're two whistleblowers that found very disgusting things over at Hines, and something that everybody out there ought to know about what's going on. And Jermaine, you're a social worker. Tell me about some of the things that you've seen over at Hines.
I'm a social worker, but I'm also the president of our local union.
Right.
I represent professionals. So not only have I had personal experience of the retaliation, but I hear hundreds of stories of employees that come to me in tears wanting to do something right, but are afraid of losing their jobs.
What kind of things?
Anything from like patient care, what Dr. Nee has talked about, that things aren't being done in the best way, and focusing on the health care of the veteran, and to people just bringing up issues of suggestions and how to do something better. They are retaliated against.
Well, in your testimony, you referred to, you said early in your career, you were exposed to what you called the toxic culture of fear.
Mm-hmm.
Is that because that's just the automatic response to any kind of suggestion or, discovering something?
Oh, right. I'll tell you exactly what happened. I was working in mental health, and we had positive tests in the water with Legionnaire's disease, Legionella in the water. And so I had asked in a meeting that said, come and ask questions, if we should notify the veterans that there is positive Legionella in the water and give them a choice whether they want to stay here or they want to go somewhere in the community. And right then a physician got up, got in my face with beet red, and said, how many Pandora boxes do you want to open? And I said, as many as it takes to protect our veterans. From that day on, my career at the VA was over.
Because of the possibility of Legionnaires' disease mm-hmm. in the water supply.
Mm-hmm.
So what is it? Is it just because it's government and it's a bureaucracy? You know, Dr. Needs, you said there's if this were private business, you know, there would be people held accountable. There would be people going to jail. There would be financial liability issues. But yet it just seems like this is systemic. And, you know, we go through new VA administrators, VA secretaries. Everybody's going to, you know, step up and take accountability. And nothing seems to change. What is it?
Well, I think that's the problem. You know, Shinseki said it himself, that he didn't know that these numbers were being manipulated, the wait times. That message didn't get to him, and I believe him, because by the time the data gets to the VA secretary, it has been whitewashed, it's been twisted, it's been manipulated in such a way that gives a picture that's not really true.
And with those wait times, you also had fraudulent activity going on to kind of cover that up as well.
And nobody has been held accountable for the wait time scandal.
Well, and indeed, there was the report that came out last week that the Department of Veterans Affairs paid out more than $142 million in bonuses to executives and employees for performance in 2014 in the midst of all of this issue of the wait times.
Well, and that brings us to, I like to bring proof and evidence forward. If people want to make an argument that I'm not really clear in what I'm speaking about, I always like to have the evidence before them. And there was a recent investigation at Hines, and it's now on the internet. This is public. And that investigation found that there were violations of a federal law involving fraud. And that physician was paid $28,000 in a retention bonus. So what you can conclude from that is that Hines VA retains criminals. The taxpayer is paying money to retain a criminal. That's the only conclusion you can come to with these two documents.
Part of your testimony also got to the point where you had the inspector general, and then somebody that's above the inspector general.
Three or four now separate investigations.
But they discovered fraudulent billing activity.
They did.
Mm-hmm.
And that's their words.
That's their words in the report. They have charts, graphs. I mean, they did a very in-depth statistical analysis of it to prove it.
And they wanted the Department of Justice to come in.
Well, and that's what I was going to lead to,
right.
Is that there was a recommendation that there is criminal, you know, there should be a criminal investigation being done.
There should be a criminal investigation.
But there wasn't one.
There was not one because the Office of Inspector General said no. And they're the prosecutorial arm of the VHA. And so what you need is Congress to step forward and say, you can't override your own investigations. If there's a preponderance of evidence that says there's criminal activity, the Department of Justice has to get involved and follow through.
So it has to go to an investigation, say, would have to go to the very top of the Inspector General's office for referral to the Department.
That is true. And they prohibit that. It doesn't matter what all these other investigative arms come forward with. The OIG puts a stop to it. And you can't have that.
And you can't have the VA policing the VA.
Well, I was just going to say that's exactly what it sounds like. And here again, part of that systemic culture and cash that exists.
A lot of cash. There's a lot of jobs. There's a lot of people not working very hard. And they want protection.
And the OIG, when I first made my disclosures over a year and a half ago, I was being ordered to report to the criminal division of the OIG. And everything that I came forward with has been substantiated by investigations. The final report isn't out yet, but I was told and treated like a criminal. And told that I had to give the names of the people who gave me the secret wait list. And I refused, saying, unless you give these employees complete immunity, you will not know their names and you will not know where they got them from. Now, how are we going to provide health care to our veterans if we can't give people protections? And it's an out for them. If we don't have the person to come forward, and in an atmosphere, in a culture of retaliation, who in their right mind is going to do a career sabotage on themselves?
Jermaine, as I recall, I think it was you in the subcommittee mentioned that you were meeting with a staff member of Senator Mark Kirk when the police
showed up in my office. A false police report was made on me.
That's part of the retaliation. Mm-hmm. They'll have the police stop you for things that are just trumped up charges. And because Hines is its own entity, they really do have the oversight over you. They are the federal police. And that's very fearful for a lot of employees. I mean, who's going to stand up and say, you know?
And you have no recourse, because I sent an email to the director saying I was harassed. The police showed up. A false police report was done. I've never gotten a response. And they just sit back and probably laugh, thinking, okay, we're going to continue this. So I don't have the legal consequent, you know, to protect myself from that kind of behavior. I mean, it's very intimidating when you have two Hines police officers coming to your office and coming to arrest you.
And you're talking to a representative of a senator.
Yes.
Dr. Nee, you said with an election year coming up, what you want people to get involved.
I do. I mean, this is really a social justice issue. If you want to put veteran and patient lives at risk for ineptitude and stupidity, and the taxpayer's okay with that, that's one thing. But you're not going to put people's lives at risk for a bounty, meaning the bonuses, because that's felonious. That's criminal. And every person needs to stand up and say, no, that's not a system we want for the men and women who fought for our freedom. I wouldn't want it in private hospital if I was a patient, and they shouldn't have to tolerate that either. They're not second-class citizens. They're the people who fought for us to do the things that we do every day.
Dr. Lisa Nee, thank you very much for joining me this morning. Jermaine Clarnow, thank you as well. I appreciate it, and thanks for hopefully we're getting this kind of information out
thank
to
you.
The public.
Thank you very much.
We'll be back with more right after this. Up ahead on the Sunday Spin, we'll be talking to former Illinois House Republican leader Tom Cross. We'll be talking about the Springfield stalemate as well as an upcoming event at Aurora University.
This is the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN. Once again, here's Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune.
312-981-7200 is our phone number, 837 on this bright, sunny Sunday morning. Temperature is supposed to get up to around 60, and looks like above average temperatures all week, even though it looks like some rain coming midweek. And I'm hoping it'll dry off by the time I head out to Aurora on Thursday to help moderate this panel, Fixing Illinois Politics and Policy in the Prairie State, part of the Town Square series at Aurora University. And joining me to talk about that and other things is Tom Cross, the former Republican leader of the Illinois House. How are you, Tom?
I'm great. How are you?
Wow, you sound all awake and excited.
I'm great. I was at the gym earlier. I figured I had to work out before came on with you. And the sun's out, and looks like it's going to be a great day.
Well, I'm glad you did. I hope you worked out for me as well.
Consider that done. Yeah, you don't have to work out today. It's done.
Yeah, I think, as I've told some friends, one of the stupidest questions I think ever asked at Tribune Tower was when a colleague who actually worked in the Middle East Bureau of the Tribune and came back to Chicago, and he asked me where the gym was at Tribune Tower. I know.
I've never seen one there.
Yeah, but there is one, but I sure wouldn't know where to find it. Tom, tell me exactly what I'm going to be doing on Thursday out at Aurora University.
Well, this is our first in what we call a town series, Town Square series, and we want to have, you know, topical conversations on important issues of the day, both at the state and national level. And so two guys, as you know, wrote a book, Jim Nolan and Tom Johnson, and they've got in there, it's a very, it was just issued in 2014 some ideas of how we reform Illinois. They're two guys that understand Springfield, have been around. Jim Nolan was in the House for a couple of terms, and Tom Johnson was the Director of Revenue, Department of Revenue, and also President of the Taxpayers Federation of Illinois. So they have some substantive ideas. They're guys that understand the politics of Springfield. And it's timely in that, you know, we're going through this whole budget mess, as you well know. And they've got some. They're going to discuss some ideas. We thought that you would be the ideal person to moderate, and to also, of course, opine on some issues if you want to. So I think we have a great conversation. That we're going to have a great conversation Thursday night at Aurora University, and a very timely topic. So I think it's going to be a great night.
Well, and I think, you know, maybe the book is even more timely now than actually when Jim Nolan and Tom Johnson wrote it.
I think it is. I was thinking about being on your show. Is the problem for all legislators, and the public needs to know, there aren't any easy choices anymore. There are not going to be any tough choices. People are not going to leave Springfield whenever this happens, whenever there's some finality to the budget situation. In a happy state, legislators love to leave happy when they leave Springfield. But these guys lay out some ideas from redistricting, to changing the way we do redistricting from a reform standpoint, to, you know, taking on pensions and Medicaid, the size of government, things that frankly need to be discussed and have been discussed, but not necessarily acted on over the last few years or decades.
Well, and you know, they address some like third rail topics too in their recommendations. And speaking of ways to kind of change the tax system, frankly, ways to bring in revenue. They touch on the fact of how Illinois does not tax retirement benefits.
You look at, they've got that, and then they talk about the sales tax. Do you take the sales tax, for instance, and broaden it? We have a fairly, limited, I don't want to say limited, but there are other states that have broadened the services, if you will, that can be taxed. So things like that, I mean, even the governor, as a Republican, has talked about the need for additional revenue. So, yeah, it's very, very timely and very appropriate. And we have had a very, which to me is indicative of the of what you're saying, that there's been a great response of people wanting to come. So I think these guys, it'll be thought provoking, and with the three of you, and I think it will turn into, I believe, a very, very good night.
Well, I somehow I'm going to drag you on the stage as well, because I think you could provide some relevance into what's going on. Now, this is a free event, and for details, you can go to AU Arts and Ideas, one word, auartsandideas.com, or you can call 630-844-4924. And I mean, part of what's, I was actually hoping that with the timing of this, it was supposed to be the day after the first sit down of the governor and the four tops, the four legislative leaders. It was supposed to be the day after.
Right.
The first time that these guys have sat down in a room together and talked. And now it was just announced yesterday, Speaker Madigan's father-in-law passed away. He was not going to be able to make this meeting on Wednesday, and he was going to send one of his committee chairman to substitute. And the governor says, well, no, we all should be there, and out of respect to Speaker Madigan, we postponed the meeting of the governor and the four tops to December 1st. And I keep wondering why. I recognize, and this is not to not express any sympathy for the speaker's position, but why do we have to wait till December 1st? There are critical services and critical issues that need to be addressed. Why do we have to wait till December 1st? And I'm not asking you to speak on that on behalf of the governor, but I'm just troubled by that.
by the way, before I forget, this event is 7:30 Thursday night at Aurora University at Crimi Auditorium. So, and thanks for the the website. I do think it's going to be a great night. Look, I think it's we need the sooner we can address all these issues, obviously, the better. I think I'm of the mindset that this thing might not, it could get settled the 1st of January. That's one of the theories that, people come back from the holidays, the Democrats need fewer votes to pass something, or the General Assembly needs fewer votes. I shouldn't say the Democrats. People will have filed their petitions. But then you're going into the primary season. It could be into March before it gets done. And I'm of the theory it could even potentially be into November after the next election. But people are truly being impacted. You're going to be at Aurora University Thursday night, and you'll find out, I suspect somebody from the audience will want to talk about the fact that the MAP program has not been funded, the monetary assistance program for college kids, and that impacts kids at Aurora and all the universities. So, yeah, it's very timely, there is a need to get this done, but I just think that we have two pretty strong individuals in the governor and the speaker, and I'm not so sure this is going to get done as quickly as people would like it to get done.
We're speaking to Tom Cross, former Illinois House Republican leader. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson, and joining me on the phone is former Illinois House Republican leader Tom Cross. And we're talking about this event, the inaugural event in the Town Square series at Aurora University at 7:30 on Thursday. It's a free event. The authors of Fixing Illinois and their four decades of expertise. And I don't want to get into how many decades I've got of expertise. Or
we didn't put that on the flyer.
Yeah, thank you very much. Thank you. Appreciate it. So you can find more details at auartsandideas.com. Tom, before the break, we were talking about, we've got Governor Rauner, we've got Speaker Madigan, two people very confident in where they're coming from on this. And I kind of wanted to ask you about, you've dealt with Speaker Madigan before, but when we've done this kind of thing in the past, not that we've ever had this long without a budget, but we've basically been dealing with people who are creatures of government. And this was always kind of the unknown question when Governor Rauner was elected. He's not a creature of government, of the institution of government. And, that was, frankly, part of the reason he got elected. But, is there also inherently in that a problem of not having that kind of institutional background?
Look, I think it can play both ways, and I think it can be a negative, but I think it can be a huge positive. And I think in the governor's mind right now, and I think I happen to agree with this, if you look over the last 10 years or 12, or someone could say 20 or 30, but let's just pick the last 5 to 10 years, we've been going down a road, at least from a budget standpoint, that hasn't worked. And we would pass budgets, and everybody knew in the building in Springfield, not sure the public paid that much attention, that the budgets weren't balanced. And so you've got the numbers on the budget. Obviously, the governor's got other issues that he wants to talk about from a structural standpoint on work-related items. But we've had to have this conversation. It's an uncomfortable conversation. It impacts people. It hurts people. I don't say that in any frivolous way, but I think the governor not being part of it and saying, we've got to make changes. And I think he also, the dynamic that I think is very real, I don't think he is, again, I don't think frivolous, I don't think he cares if he wins his next election. So you've got a unique individual in the governor's office who's willing to take on an institution and confront the issues that really, really need to be confronted. And he's got credibility by being a guy that has said, I know we need revenue, and I'm willing to do that. And not many Republican governors around the country are willing to say that. So, yeah, I think it plays both ways. But I think in this situation, we've got to do things differently. But we cannot continue to spend money we don't have, and that's what's been going on.
Tom, we've got a question from a caller who asked about, when we were talking about changing kind of the tax structure, about the possibility of lowering the tax rate and broadening the tax base. And I think that's kind of been part of the discussion, and certainly it'll be part of the discussion in that Fixing Illinois Town Square series, of if you were to broaden the sales tax to include services, there's the potential of, you know, being able to adjust some tax rates.
Yeah, that's exactly what's talked about. And I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I think you could see, depending on what you include in the broadening, if you will, of the sales tax, I think you'd see some significant revenue increase. Look, I think it's been part of the discussion. He's been very clear about that. I don't know where ultimately this revenue stream, where they go, but it's going to be a component of a final budget discussion. Look, none of these. Here's the other problem going on. You've got the whole issue of the speaker and the governor, two strong personalities. I said this, I think, at the beginning. There are no easy solutions. Legislators love to go home being able to say, I got more money for education. I did this. I did that. No one's going to do that when this thing is over. It's going to be a revenue increase. Probably in all likelihood, be a revenue increase. There are going to be some structural changes.
And there are going to be some cuts.
I was talking to Dennis Culton the other day. You know, Dennis, back in 2002, Governor Ryan calls it, we're in overtime. I think you were there. We're in June. And Dennis worked for the governor. And the governor gives this speech to the General Assembly and really tears into him, saying, we've got to get this budget balanced. We're going to have some cuts. And forget about elections. And Dennis was with him, I think, probably wrote the speech. And after the speech of the General Assembly, where they weren't happy with what the governor said, he looked at Dennis and said, hey, where were the applause lines? They're not going to be any applause lines when this is all said and done. This is going to be very, very difficult. Some tough, tough decisions on a lot of fronts. And members of the General Assembly are going to make some tough votes that aren't going to please most people. And that's what's going on. I think that's part of this as well, in addition to this kind of epic struggle between the two guys on labor issues and business issues.
So you think it's partly a waiting game to get through filing for the filing period for the March ballot?
I think it's become that. I think it didn't have to start out that way, but once you got through the summer, then you had people saying, well, you know, whoa, we've got to circulate petitions and we've got primaries. Look, I think this thing, you know, barring a catastrophe or a Chicago school meltdown with a strike or whatever, I think this thing could go on a while and even longer. Obviously, it's gone on a while. I think it could go on even longer.
Well, and I've told people, you know, given the extent that it's gone on now, I wouldn't be surprised to see Governor Rauner standing in the General Assembly delivering the 2017 fiscal year budget address, and we still don't have a fiscal year 2016 budget.
I totally agree with that. I think that potential is there. But look, I mean, the problem we have is that the General Assembly, you know, we don't have a budget, but there's, because of court orders, there are, you know, the continuation of spending money we don't have is going on, and that's going to come to a head. I don't know when. It'll probably be spring, sometime in the spring. So you've got all these just financial issues that are ongoing that we really don't pay attention to, and one day someone may wake up and say, hey, we don't have any money to even make payroll. So that may drive the issue as well. But I think there's a distinct possibility, you're right about that, when he does the budget address, that we won't see one before that.
Well, we'll be talking a lot about this on Thursday over at Aurora University for the Town Square series. Tom Cross, former Illinois House Republican leader, thank you very much for joining me this morning, and I'll see you on Thursday.
Thanks for having me, and thanks for being part of our program at Aurora. Thanks. We'll see you Thursday.
We'll be back with more right after this. Well, that's all we have time for on this week's edition of the Sunday Spin. I want to thank my guests, 12th Ward Alderman George Cardenas, Dr. Lisa Nee and Jermaine Clarno, whistleblowers at Hines VA Medical Center, and former Illinois House Republican leader Tom Cross. And most of all, I want to thank you all for getting up and listening to the show. And now we move to the great Dean Richards.
Well, the Dean Richards show today that'll be a little more somber, certainly, than last week's when we were out at Tree Time. We'll continue the discussion, talk to a couple of different sources in Paris this morning as we try to make some sense out of everything that went down there, that's for sure.
It's when you talk about sense and terrorism, it's hard to put that together.
Hard to put those two words in the same sentence. I mean, it's that same sort of punch in the stomach feeling that we've seen so many times, but we've got some pretty good experts to offer some new perspective, some people who were there that were actually in Paris and experienced what this kind of madness is about. Try to work in all of our regular features as well. It's not going to be a completely serious show today, but I think we've got a lot of good stuff between now and one. Rick, have a great day today. Thank you very much.